Greetings, and welcome to the Gramercy Update, the outlook and opportunities in these unprecedented times. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A question-and-answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star zero on your telephone keypad. Today's call is by invitation only. Members of the press and those who did not receive an invitation directly from Gramercy are asked to leave the call at this time. The content of this call is confidential and may not be reproduced or redistributed, in part or in whole, by any means without the prior written consent of Gramercy. During this call, Gramercy's management may make certain forward-looking statements based on current expectations, forecasts, and assumptions that involve risks and uncertainties. These statements represent opinions based on information available to Gramercy as of the date of the call, and Gramercy's actual results of actions could differ materially from those stated or implied due to risks and uncertainties associated with this business. The information discussed on this call does not constitute an offer to sell or the solicitation of an offer to purchase any securities, including those of any fund managed by Gramercy. Past results are not necessarily indicative of future results, and no representation is made that any particular results can be achieved. The potential investments discussed are not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice or a recommendation to purchase or sell any particular security. This call is being recorded and a replay will be distributed. Please use only your first name to identify yourself during the Q&A session. I will now turn the call over to Mr. Robert Koenigsberger, founding partner and CIO of Gramercy. Thank you. You may begin.
Great. Thank you very much. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today. We know that your time is precious, and we appreciate you giving it to us today. In that light, we apologize for the difficulties, the technical difficulties of getting into the call today. We certainly hope that you and your families are well in light of the current dislocation that we're all facing. We wanted to use this call to reach out, give a quick update on Gramercy, global markets, emerging markets, and in particular in light of the current CV-19 crisis. To begin with, I'm extremely grateful for the smooth transition that we've made to working remotely. Our technology team has done a fantastic job of keeping us connected and highly functional. All of our systems have supported us as intended and have kept us fully operational. This in turn has permitted us to protect our client portfolios, stay connected with portfolio investments, and most importantly, stay connected as a team. The marriage of the top-down macro perspectives anchored in our relationship with Mohamed Alarian and managed by our sovereign research team with the strong bottoms-up analysis is working well and has created outperformance in both our relative and absolute value strategies. While we continue to play defense, we're now also turning to offense. The dislocated opportunity set that we've been underwriting for quite some time and speaking to you all about in our public credit strategies has arrived, and we're hard at work today underwriting those as we speak. At the same time, our capital solutions team is currently vetting rescue finance loans backed by strong, uncorrelated collateral packages, and our special situations team is hard at work investigating how we can expand our insurance claim strategies to include business interruption claims relative to CV-19. As many of you know, Mohamed Alarian joined us about a year ago as a senior advisor. We've had the great fortune of being able to work with Mohamed. I think he's one of the most brilliant top-down minds out there, and he's worked very hard with us to help us incorporate and bring the top-down macro analysis into the already strong bottoms-up analysis that we've relied on for 22 years as a team. Mohamed's a perfect fit for our platform. He brings the top-down. He decodes, he helps us decode what's going on in the world from an economic perspective. We have the added benefit that Mohamed's an investor. So not only do we decode it, but we get to understand the implications for investments. And then lastly, he shares a passion for emerging markets. So it's a pleasure to have Mohamed join us here today. In addition to the macro, I've in particular enjoyed his partnership, thinking about how to manage in a time like this and be able to take advantage of his experience at PIMCO and elsewhere during the financial crisis and what have you, and to really help us think about how do we anticipate and navigate the current crisis? And then equally important, how do we and our clients and our portfolios emerge stronger on the other side? So without further delay, I'd like to thank Mohammed for joining us today, and Mohammed, pass it over to you.
Thank you, Robert. And let me start, like you, by thanking everybody for calling in. And like you, let me wish everybody well. I know that this is a highly uncertain and unsettling time for us and for our families. And I wish you all the best possible during these times. And Robert, thank you for your kind words. It's really been my honor and pleasure to work with you and colleagues. What I'm going to do for the next 8 to 10 minutes is provide a summary overview of where I think we currently stand on global economic and policy issues. I will do so by stressing six very quick points that I hope speak to the following bottom line. With the announcement starting last Tuesday of these massive Fed emergency interventions, the focused ones, and today with the agreement between the Senate and the White House on the fiscal package, the global economy and markets have avoided for now getting to a really nasty place very quickly. The nasty place was a self-feeding, simultaneous economic and financial deleveraging. That's the good news, and it's very good news. But neither the economy nor the markets are out of the woods yet. A tough path lies ahead, which will involve significant economic and financial damage and require even more policy intervention. The basic reason why we're not out of the woods yet is because we don't have a handle on the severity and duration of the coronavirus and therefore on its impact on the economy. So what supports this bottom line? First is understanding why the coronavirus is so destructive. It is something that is seen in fragile or failing states, or a community hit by a massive natural disaster. It is not seen at the level of a big country, let alone at the level of a global economy. And that is a simultaneous destruction of consumption and production. It's because the health policy approach, which is self-distancing, isolation, is inherently inconsistent with the way our economies are wired. And as health takes priority, the economy gets hit very hard. Add on top of that what uncertainty and fear does to people, and you have a significant economic deleveraging, which contaminates the financial system, and then you have the risk of the financial system reverse contaminating the economy. And if there aren't circuit breakers, you're even looking at the possibility of a combination of a 1930s depression and a 2008 financial crisis. But we've had policies, we've had an all-in, whatever it takes, whole-of-government approach, and that is the good side of it. The less good side of it is that the policy response is starting late and already significant damage has been created. And the even less good part of the policy response, it can do a lot to protect the most vulnerable segment of society. It can do a lot to try to keep some companies afloat. It can do a lot to minimize the risk of market failures, and it can do a lot to protect the most strategic sector, including healthcare. But, and this is a really important but, it cannot restart economic activity. Because as you know, no matter how much tax breaks we get, how low interest rates are, how easily we can refinance a mortgage into a cheaper one, that's not going to get us to go out and interact, and the government doesn't even want us to do that. Which means that while we have pushed a pause button on simultaneous self-feeding economic and financial deleveraging that would cause a depression, we haven't and we're not going to avert a major recession. There's going to be a lot of economic damage ahead. Policy is not going to be able to get to all the places. The pipes aren't there. And there will be institutional, social, and political consequences. Solutions, my fourth point, you need medical progress, and this is how you judge it. Do individuals feel more confident about three things? First, the ability to identify and contain the spread of the virus. Testing is critical here, but there are other measures. Two, the ability to treat illness better. And that's why you see this major focus on getting ventilators to hospitals, creating more hospital beds, et cetera. And three, increasing immunity. A vaccine fast forwards this process. Otherwise, it's all about piecemeal approaches, hopefully reaching critical mass, but that won't happen very soon. Once that happens, you can restart the global economy. But restarting a global economy is not easy. I can give you very sophisticated reasons why, but I'll give you a very simple example. I was on the phone yesterday with the CEO of a major hotel company. As you can imagine, they are in complete crisis management mode and trying to survive. They're about to lay off 80% of the labor force. And when asked, what happens if in 4 weeks you get the all clear and people suddenly want to stay in hotels, he said, well, if that happens, I'm going to have enormous difficulty finding the workers again. So restarts are not as easy. Which leads me to the final point, and this is important for investment implications because you want to both navigate the journey and prepare for the new destination. The post-crisis landscape will be different. It will be different because we have shocked globalization. It will be different because we have shocked productivity, and we have shocked debt dynamics and central bank dynamics. We will also come out with a deeper entanglement of governments and private activity. And there's going to be another host of issues that are as important but of less direct relevance to investment. But I'm happy to get to them in the Q&A. Bottom line is, if you think in terms of a marathon, the coronavirus got a stealth start on us and got really far before policy started running. If you are to take a snapshot of where we are, the devastating impact on the economy of the coronavirus is way ahead of the ability of policy to contain it. But if you look at the deltas, policy is catching up, and how quickly policy catch up ultimately ends up being a health issue rather than an economic and financial issues. Thank you, Robert. I'll stop there.
Great. Thanks, Mohammed. At this point, what I wanted to do is spend a little bit of time speaking to some of the implications in emerging markets. I thought the best lens to do that might be via the top-down process that we've been working on with Mohammed, and share some of the recent conclusions in our most recent top-down macro meeting last week. And it's, you know, buckets into three basic themes. The first one being, as Mohammed mentioned, you know, global growth impact is going to be significant. And the recovery is going to be dependent on the effectiveness of the containment that Mohammed just spoke to. You know, we did an internal poll in terms of whether we anticipate a V-shaped recovery, U-shaped recovery, W-shape, and it's more heavily weighted towards a U-shape as being the highest probability recovery. But what we certainly expect is that the growth and the recovery won't be pro rata, and that there'll be differentiation in timing and magnitudes across different markets, different countries, and ultimately different credits. Equally important theme, too, we've talked a lot about as a group is, you know, the the unprecedented policy response, and what that's going to mean and when it's going to mean it. And the coordination and the scope of what we have seen and are going to see is certainly going to be unprecedented. In our world in emerging markets, you know, we can already see the multilateral support, IMF, World Bank. We've seen over 80 countries already ask for these, shall we call them, IMF flexible funds, this first $50 billion that they're going to allocate to the crisis. And indeed, it's paid to go early. You know, there's been limited conditionality for that first $50 billion. Even the likes of Venezuela thought they would give it a try, but they were obviously rejected. And we think that these programs will be most beneficial for the sovereigns that have, you know, small short-term needs. They have liquidity needs and not balance sheet issues, which is an important theme going forward, which is as we deal with this dislocation, we have to be able to differentiate, you know, what's dislocated and what's impaired, you know, whether that's from a balance sheet perspective, solvency perspective, et cetera. And theme three has really been about, you know, the aftermath of this. There's certainly, in our minds, will be a change in the state of nature, or a bit of an erosion of the buy the dip mentality that's been around probably for the better part of the past 10 years since the financial crisis. And we're going to have to be focused on, you know, as Mohammed said, the new destination. You know, one of the things that we're going to have to think about is the diversification of supply chains and who the winners and losers in that process might be. And then lastly, kind of top down, you know, we're really focused on politics because, you know, with politics and the change of politics in emerging markets comes policies and change of policies. And, you know, we always find it humorous that people try and predict what a policy set will be for a country in 10, 20, 30 years without being able to predict who's going to win the elections in 20 or 21. We see 2020 is probably less material from a political perspective, just given that there's such a light election calendar. In Latin America, for example, the only election that we see coming forward is Dominican Republic, and perhaps that will be delayed given what's gone on. But 2021 is going to be a much more important year. Again, if we use Latin America as an example, we'll have elections in Ecuador for president. We'll have midterm elections in Mexico, and we'll have presidential and legislative elections in Chile. In terms of kind of broad market implications, you know, some of the characteristics that we think are going to follow is we're going to continue to see volatility and asset price pressure. What we're dealing with is multifaceted. It's unprecedented. You know, if you put the equity market in perspective, we're just about down, you know, the same amount we were in December of 2008 from a peak to trough. Obviously, what we're dealing with here is much more material and impactful. To us, you know, it feels like at least a combination of 2008 and September 11th. The difference was in September 11th, perhaps you were nervous to go out, but you could still go out. So as Mohammed said, I don't think everybody quite understands the implications and what some of the data is going to look like on the other side. But, you know, top down, you know, we're going to stay focused on strong, you know, favoring strong, resilient balance sheets, higher quality credits, you know, basically what we wrote about at year end, which is higher quality credits, lower duration, pull to par, if you will, and be less susceptible to the volatility and the dislocation risk. The oil market uncertainty certainly warrants caution, and that's an area that we think there could definitely be a change in the state of nature, and that one shouldn't just expect a V-shaped recovery of oil-related risk. And then, you know, one's got to think about the avoidance in portfolios and careful selection of some of the most vulnerable sectors. You know, Mohammed just mentioned hotels, entertainment, airline carriers, et cetera. It's not just going to be, wow, this is over, turn the switch, and all this comes back. So there's going to have to be a lot of credit differentiation. And ultimately, what we're going to be focused on is trying to identify credits that are lower because of illiquidity, and not credits that are lower because of increased credit risk. In terms of, you know, a few comments around the bottoms up or the market itself, you know, as we wrote at year end and we've talked about for quite some time, to be honest, we're not that surprised by the dislocation. We've You know, we've seen this perfect storm waiting to happen. You know, we've talked a lot about the transformation of risk in 2008 in emerging markets, and particularly if you use corporate credit as an example. You know, in 2008, you know, there was this big move from, quote, illiquid vehicles to liquid vehicles, you know, what from 90-day, 120-day alternative structures to UCITS, 40 Acts, and ETFs. And there was this promise of liquidity, despite the fact that there was a mismatch that just because the underlying ETF is supposedly liquid doesn't mean that the portfolio itself is liquid. So while all this has happened in the last 10 years, emerging markets, if we use corporates again as a benchmark, they're about almost five times larger than they were in 2008 at the crisis. Yet we all know that the number of banks and the amount of balance sheet that the banks have dedicated to making markets is materially less than it used to be. So you have this, you know, you have this mismatch or this perfect storm waiting to happen. The straw to break the camel's back. We didn't know what the shock would be, but we knew that it would catalyze outflows, and that's, you know, we've certainly seen a lot of outflows, and we think that's what's driving the dislocation. And our work is to figure out what investments or potential investments are available because of illiquidity and are to be avoided because of the impairment of what the world looks like on the other side. So kind of where do we stand today? I mean, you know, what does this dislocation look like in absolute terms, and how does it feel relative to historical terms? You know, having spent, you know, 30 plus years as individuals, 22 years as a team, we kind of wanted to go back, and we've had this conversation with many of you. Is kind of, you know, there's been 9 major dislocations in our market in the past 25 years. The average drawdown it's taken about 5 months, and it's been on average 20% drawdown. The recovery period to go back from the trough to the previous peak on average was 8 months. And the historical debt, the historical returns in those indices over that period of time was about 27%. And if you look 12 to 24 months forward, you see about 30 to 55% return. So where does, you know, and those crises were anything from the tequila crisis in Mexico, the Asian flu in 1997, the vodka crisis in Russia in 1998, the financial crisis, et cetera. So this one, I guess we call the coronavirus shock. And if we look at, you know, the peak in our market, it was just a month ago. We're down about, as of the 23rd, we're down about 20% peak to trough using the emerging markets bond index. So it leads us to believe that some of the historical returns that were embedded in these recoveries are out there today. As I said before, we want to be a bit more cautious. We think that this could be a combination of prior crises, and that you're not supposed to average them. It's probably you're supposed to add them, if you will. And it's leading us to think about, as we always talk about, plan the trade and trade the plan. So the way that we're thinking about this is kind of taking this down in thirds. If we're thinking about the dislocation strategy, we're down about 20%. That's down about the average. We think it makes sense to start underwriting this. We've been underwriting it for quite some time, and we're underwriting it. But we're not intelligent enough to predict the bottom or buy the bottom, and we want to be able to save some firepower for maybe down 25 and down 30. The challenge that we see in this market is, you know, it's easy to talk to people about a dislocation before it occurs, and you say, look, if in 06 and 07 you talk about 08, you know, would you buy a March of 09? And everyone's like, of course. But when you call them, you know, in the end of 2008, it's really difficult to get focus. And, you know, what we encourage people to do is you know, we all have to continue to play defense, but there is an opportunity out here to attack the opportunity set and to get recovery in portfolios that is so needed. And some of the returns that came in 2009 and 10, we think will be also available on the other side of this crisis. So, and a little bit later, Matt Maloney will be talking a bit more about how we're thinking about attacking this within public credit. But at this time, I'd like to pass it over to Philip Meyer in London, who heads up our emerging market debt strategies, to give a little bit of color in terms of what's going on there.
Thank you, Robert, and good morning to everyone. I want to talk a little bit about how we entered the sell-off in the EMD strategies, what happened in the market and what happened to us and what we are doing now and what we are planning to do in the future. And that should be for the next couple of minutes. So as Robert and Mohammed already highlighted, our top-down view is really important, especially for the EMD strategies. And late in 2019, early 2020, we have basically analyzed the opportunity cost of reducing risk and agreed among all of us that they were relatively low because valuations were very stretched and very expensive. So from December onwards, but mostly in January and into February, we have basically used the opportunity to reduce risk in our EMD strategies. And it really depends on the strategy. We have kind of corporate strategies, high yield corporate strategies, allocation strategies that are like blended strategies. And for the corporate strategies, we have reduced high yield. For the allocation strategies, we have reduced from local currency. And overall, we have reduced from cyclical sectors like oil and gas and metals and mining. And also, we have reduced from triple B minuses in anticipation of ratings migration. And actually, there are a couple of bonds that we have sold in January and February that are now down about 40 points because they eventually got downgraded. So that's kind of how we entered the sell-off. So with reduced risk compared to, let's say, the fourth quarter of 2019, and with a pretty healthy cash position, because from the kind of things we stole that I've just mentioned, we have not switched much. We have actually put it into cash. So that's kind of how the strategies were positioned. So what has happened then is basically that this kind of got priced in with a velocity I have never seen before, and that was clearly amplified by ETF selling, and Robert spoke about it, and obviously Robert and Mohammed have written this great piece early this year about kind of liquidity in our market. And especially hard currency sovereigns got hit very hard, and everything that's considered liquid and on the run. So if you have the on the run 10-year bond in a EM sovereign that's in the indices, those bonds are down massively. And I just want to give you a few numbers that you really understand the magnitude about the impact on the asset class. So the MB Sovereign Hard Currency Index, as Robert said, is down nearly 20% year to date. The SEMBI Hard Currency Corporate Index is down nearly 13%. And for both indices, the IG component is down around, I would say, 7 to 10%, and the high yield component is down 20 to 25%. So a clear underperformance of high yield here. GBIEM is the local currency index, which is down, and that's only sovereigns, by the way, which is down 18%, of which the FX component is 15% of that 18%. So it's more an FX kind of play than anything else. And I've also prepared you a few names. Chile, for example, is down 14%, the index component, 14% for Chile, which is still a single A and perceived to be a relatively stable country within Latin America. And many more are also down double digits. I think that's very important to mention. So what does that mean for us and what we are doing? At the moment, the observation is that investors are actually getting punished for being liquid and on the run. They are not necessarily getting punished yet for being in the wrong credit, because actually the stuff where ETFs got a bit is down sometimes much more than rather off-the-run names that probably have credit issues on the other side of this, as Robert has highlighted. So for us, that gives us a great opportunity to work with our sizable analyst pool and really analyze our portfolios and strategies name by name and basically decide what's something we want to have on the other side, kind of what's the risk we want to take and what's the risk we don't want to take. And I think at the moment, with liquidity coming back a little bit over the last couple of days, as Mohammed said, there is a little bit of a backstop in place now. There is the ability to do switches. And I think that's kind of very important. I've also brought you a couple of examples here. For example, Sub-Saharan Africa is on average down 30 to 35 points in hard currency. There are certain countries in CEE, for example, that have IMF support that are only 5 points less down. So that's for us, that switch makes sense because you switch out of countries that are depending on oil and also will probably have a harder time fighting coronavirus than other EMs that are a bit more developed into countries in CEE, which are much more developed and less impacted by oil price. And some of them even have an IMF program. Also within the Middle East, since Saudi Arabia started this oil war, we think among the kind of weaker credits, you can switch into those that are closer to Saudi Arabia, where we expect the bailout because they don't want to let their brothers go down just because they started an oil price war. Also, what we are doing is looking actively into selling weak triple B minuses where there is downgrade potential, and buying quality double B pluses to avoid index exclusion technicals. And I think before I conclude, I get a lot of question about EM in terms of the dislocation relative to developed markets. And we have done some extensive work on that. And if you exclude the oil and gas sector, for example, from the U.S. high yield index and the EM high yield index, we are actually at the moment around 100 basis points cheap. So EM is attractive here, even if it looks like U.S. high yield has sold off massively. But it's mainly the smaller oil and gas players in that index that have pushed it down. If we exclude it from both indices, actually, EM high yield is very attractive. Also, U.S. high yield and U.S. investment grade and EM investment grade have performed largely in line. We still feel, and that's excluding oil and gas and including oil and gas, we still feel you have a much more diversified and a much more quality type of universe in EM IG, given the fact that a lot of these companies, at least partially owned by the government, or alternatively are the top player in their market, respectively. And if you look at sovereigns, it's interesting to observe that, for example, it's difficult to compare developed market sovereigns with emerging market sovereigns because obviously they are largely in different currencies, QE, US dollar strength, rate cuts, that all plays an important role. But I've figured out one example which I wanted to highlight. There is a 2029 bond from Italy outstanding, which is down basically 1-2 points year to date. And now compare it to, for example, Chile, down 14%, or the overall MB IG index, down 10%. So that those are those emerging market sovereigns that are rated investment grade. So I feel like, given that Italy is among the hardest hit in the world, that looks like value to me. And just last but not least, given that we have those cash positions in our strategies, we're obviously also actively looking and scaling into the downtrade, as Robert highlighted, with a kind of 20% down, 25% down, 30% down. And I think most importantly, scaling into that doesn't mean that you have to really bottom fish in the lower credit spectrum. You can really buy the attractive stuff, the stuff that's fundamentally sound and will survive on the other side of this, because it's down as much as the moment because of ETF selling. And now I would like to hand it over to Gustavo, who co-heads our capital solution business, and he wants to discuss what he's seeing in private markets at the moment.
Thank you very much, Philip, and good morning to everybody. So let me give you first a quick overview of what we do in capital solutions. As many of you are aware, our vertical seeks to provide high current income on an unlevered basis, generating a return stream which is uncorrelated to traditional fixed income. So it's very different in a sense to what you just heard from Philip. We seek to do that by investing private credit opportunities across emerging markets with focus in Latin America and SEMEA. We provide highly collateralized growth capital in U.S. dollars with 3 to 4 year duration to mid-sized corporates, with EBITDA ranging from anywhere between $25 million to $250 million. Our vertical has approximately $1.2 billion in assets spread around 22 investments in private credit. Approximately 83% of our portfolio is senior secured, with the remaining 17% ranking as mezzanine. At this time, between total and partial monetizations, our strategy has realized in excess of 40% of capital. Our assets, given our strong collateral and robust LTVs, are generally performing well, even in the cases in which some reprofilings or restructuring might be necessary. Our legal structures have been performing as planned during our underwriting process, and in these limited situations where we needed to do some restructurings, we expect to meet our downside case scenarios with full recovery of principal and high single-digit returns. Separately, while our capital solutions vertical relies on our strong collateral as the first line of defense, we normally do not carry idiosyncratic hedges in our portfolio. However, on an opportunistic basis, we do consider it. And in late February, following our firm's top-down view that public fixed income assets were in many cases priced to perfection, we entered into CDS contracts covering outstanding risks in Mexico, Peru, and Brazil. And we did that at a cost nearing all-time lows. Those hedges have proven to be very effective to protect and enhance the portfolio have generated a meaningful attribution. Finally, as we see this crisis unfold, we confirm our thesis that private credit as an asset class performs well and offers opportunities in both ends of the cycle. As corporates are in need to raise cash and traditional funding sources dry out, we find an opportunity to support them while getting enhanced returns by sharing upside and at the same time getting superior protection to the downside via additional collateral and in most times uncorrelated collateral to the borrowing businesses. We came into this period with available capital and no unfunded commitments, which gives us a lot of flexibility to focus on compelling investment situations in an opportunistic manner. We're all hands on deck and very focused to make sure that we capitalize on this unique opportunity. I will now turn it to Matt Maloney, Head of Alternatives, to comment on how the firm is approaching this time of market dislocation. Matt?
Thank you, Gustavo, and good morning. The alternatives team at Gramercy heeded Mohammed's warning earlier this year that this time is different. I won't embarrass myself by attempting to summarize his thesis, but I will say that Mohammed's cautious outlook and top-down perspective is continuously influencing how we are positioning our portfolios from a defensive standpoint. Generally speaking, our hedging strategy consists of a combination of credit hedges, oil hedges, and equity hedges consistent with the exposures in our long strategies. The composition of the hedges is dynamic and changes based on current market conditions, but will include a combination of at-the-money hedges, near-the-money put spreads, and cheaper low-delta out-of-the-money put options with higher payoff multiples. This approach affords us the flexibility to monetize at-the-money hedges while always maintaining adequate tail protection. As markets sell off, at-the-money hedges are reduced first, and options positions are rolled to lock in profits and or extend downside protection as necessary. If we look more specifically at how we've tried to navigate the COVID-19-induced sell-off, our oil exposure, for example, was hedged using a combination of WTI futures via a steepener on the futures curve and deep out-of-the-money put spread on WTI futures. As oil sold off from a high of near 60 at the beginning of the year into the low 50s, we sold our position in oil futures, locking in profits while still maintaining adequate downside protection as our oil put spread was now near the money. As the sell-off in oil accelerated, we rolled the put spread down to 40 strike puts and increased the notional size by approximately 50%, locking in some profits and significantly extending our downside protection below 40. Credit exposure was hedged using a combination of single name CDS and deep out of the money swaptions on CDX IG and CDX high yield. As equity markets began to sell off and equity volatility increased significantly at the end of February, we took advantage of the mispriced implied volatility in credit ETFs and added an overlay of at the money puts in EMB and HYG. When credit markets began to sell off along with equities, we started to significantly reduce our CDS positions and opportunistically rolled our option positions on EMB and HYG to lock in profits while maintaining adequate tail protection by redeploying a small amount of our profits from CDS, EMB, and HYG into our swaption tail hedge. The depth and breadth of the market sell-off, excluding the last 48 hours, of course, has presented an opportunity to pivot from defense to offense. Our approach to taking advantage of these buying opportunities depends on volatility and pricing. In periods of high volatility, the alternatives platform is focused on public markets, marrying the unique top-down view of Mohammed and Robert with the deep primary research analyst team that employs bottom-up analysis to seek credit differentiation and avoid defaults. In periods of low volatility, the alternatives platform is focused on developing idiosyncratic platforms that offer uncorrelated alpha with material margin of safety designed to preserve capital. From a pricing perspective, we don't subscribe to the notion that markets have already put in the lows of the corona-led sell-off and that if the sell-off resumes, the ultimate drawdown could be as much as 30% for EM credit. We believe there are compelling ways to take advantage of the broad dislocation across sovereign and corporate credit, as well as construct investment strategies to capture idiosyncratic dislocations. Earlier this week, the SEMBI-MBI composite indices sold off nearly 17%, approaching drawdowns consistent with previous crises in emerging markets that Robert already highlighted. When thinking about attacking this broad dislocation, we believe in a systematic capital deployment approach that is usually broken into thirds. As Robert touched upon earlier, we have contemplated deploying capital at the following pricing milestones: one-third when indices are down around 20%, one-third when down 25%, one-third when down 30%. This plan ensures that we aren't missing the trade by trying to call the bottom. We envision a portfolio construct that slightly favors sovereigns or quasi-sovereigns over corporates, that has a reasonable geographic diversification, and that reflects average credit quality of BB or better. Credit selection will require tapping into our bottom-up resources to identify a portfolio of credits that have underperformed the broader market but still present sustainable credit metrics, defensible business or economic models, and cash flow runway. Once again, our backtesting of EM drawdowns dating back to 1994 suggests that EM credit reaches its pre-crisis peak within 8 months of the drawdown. So we assume that any broad dislocation strategy could be monetized within 1 year and should generate compelling returns on an absolute and relative basis. In addition to capturing the broad dislocation, we believe current market conditions provide an opportunity for investors to reevaluate idiosyncratic dislocations, particularly in situations where we do not foresee changes in global dynamics materially changing our underwriting, but afford us cheaper entry points versus our base case outcome. Argentina, for example, is a country with which Gramercy has had a great deal of experience and currently presents a compelling investment opportunity. As most of you know, Argentina is finally facing an attachment point that should trigger bondholder engagement on principal amortizations the sovereign can't afford. The amortization payment due May 7th on the Bonar 24s of $2.5 billion is material enough that it cannot be delayed or ignored. By the end of April, Argentina must make substantive progress towards a resolution to avoid the negative feedback loop created by a hard, messy default. We are cautiously optimistic that pragmatism will prevail and a consensual resolution will be reached. The restructuring proposal that has been socialized contemplates a combination of maturity extension, coupon reduction, and capitalization, as well as modest principal haircuts. If achieved, that restructuring would provide Argentina with the cash flow and debt relief it is seeking, as well as provide bondholders with a recovery significantly above current prices. Colombia today also presents a compelling investment opportunity. It is possible to accumulate Colombia government claims that offer investment-grade risk, but alpha in excess of 1,000 basis points to public securities. Accumulating these claims requires constructing a sourcing and processing platform that, while arduous, also provides rewarding barriers to entry. We liken this to the early days of investing in Brazilian government claims, but before the trade got crowded and investors had to go further down the quality spectrum to get yield. Current market conditions are bringing out supply from prototypical claim holders, including high net worth individuals and local pension funds and insurance companies. This is creating even deeper discounts in secondary markets. We see compelling idiosyncratic opportunities continuing to pop up, especially in sovereign dislocations like Lebanon and Ecuador and even Venezuela. We are preparing the alternatives business to take advantage of them. Now let's turn it over to the operator for Q&A.
Thank you. At this time, we'll be conducting a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment, please, while we poll for questions.
Thank you, operator. While we wait for any live questions, we have received a few questions electronically. The first question is directed to Mohammed. Mohammed, was yesterday a bear market rally or the beginning of a market recovery? And do you think the $2 trillion plan will be enough or will there be more coming?
Thank you. Let me start with the second part of the question because that comes back to the first part of the question. The second part of the question is, it will be enough to do certain things, but it will not be enough to do what's needed to be done. I suspect that we're going to learn two things very quickly about the package. One is implementation is really hard. The pipes aren't in place. Really difficult decisions have to be made. So the relief is not going to get there as fast as it needs to. That's the first thing we're going to learn. The second thing we're going to learn is that we are going to have a whole series of more damage coming out that hasn't been imagined yet. And there's going to have to be a very agile policy response, which is, explains also why there's been this political fight between what you need from an engineering perspective, which is basically a blank check to spend as you see fit, when you see fit. And on the other side, political accountability, which doesn't like writing blank checks, especially when there isn't trust between the two parties. So it is a complex engineering and implementation issue that's not going to solve quickly, which goes back to the first part of your question. I see what happened yesterday in market and today as one of those opportunities that are what I call counter-trend opportunities to reposition up in quality. That is what the market is providing you right now, in my opinion. It is not yet forming a base. It is simply providing you a short-term opportunity to reposition. My colleagues have talked about what sort of things you should be thinking about as you reposition in terms of EM. In terms of developed, you really want to be following the Fed. That is where you want to be right now, which is also an up in quality trade. And then the final thing I would say is this has to be done within a very strict risk mitigation stroke regret minimization mindset. Thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed. Another question that we have received electronically. If Biden wins the U.S. presidential election, how will that change domestic and emerging markets?
Robert, do you want to take that?
I profess to be an expert on Latin American politics, but not so much on the U.S., but I'll give it a start and I'll pass it over to you. I guess, you know, our thought about the U.S. presidential election and now, you know, the possibility of Biden being the president probably doesn't change that great what the world's going to look like in emerging markets or what some of the implications may be, i.e., I talked earlier about we should expect a change in supply chains. And I don't think that's going to matter whether Trump wins re-election or Biden comes in. This notion of everyone going to China to get the cheapest production or to concentrate all their production in one place, I think is going to change. And there's going to be implications across the investment spectrum, anticipating what those changes are going to be and who the winners and losers might be.
I completely agree with that. I think it's going to be a change at the margin. It's going to be a change in style rather than substance. But when it comes to the big issues that impact emerging markets, think of what Robert just said in terms of deglobalization, which will reflect exactly what we saw in the corporate sector after 2008, when cash was valued like crazy and people's precautionary cash demands shot up. You're going to see also people talk about resilient supply chains and worry less about just-in-time inventory and cost management and everything else. Resilience will be the key word, which means deglobalization. We're also going to see, I think, the trade tensions remain. That's now deeply embedded in the psyche in Washington. It's not just about economics. It's about national security. So I agree with Robert. It's going to be, if Vice President Biden wins, it's going to be a change in style, but not a fundamental change in substance. Thank you.
Thank you both. Operator, I'll now turn it over to you as I see we have a live question in the queue. Do you want to open that up, please?
Sure. And once again, if anyone has any questions, they can always press star one on their telephone keypad. Our next question is from Xavier. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, can you folks all hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Just a quick question. Is investor redemption activity in EM investment funds and the consequent deleveraging activity or deleveraging occurring in the latter? There's been a lot of that in the last 2 weeks. Is that going to continue putting downward price pressure on a variety of EM assets? And if so, how long do you see that continuing? Thank you very much.
Sure. I'll start then, Philip or Matt, if you guys have any anything you'd like to add to that as well. I mean, as I said earlier in my comments, the dislocation itself is being caused first by liquidity or lack thereof, and the catalyst for that has been outflows. And given this kind of mismatch between the vast size of the asset class and the small size of the market makers, this is to be expected. We're of the opinion that as the damage has been done, and that you won't see this kind of V-shaped recovery as it relates to inflows necessarily coming back to the asset class. I think it's hard for us to predict with precision kind of when it will stop, which is kind of why we're thinking about, there's value out here today. Our gut is there might be more value tomorrow. But we always like to think about, I talk about the happy trade, if you will. And so if we underwrite and take down a third of the opportunity set, and as Philip said, with higher quality credit today, and we never see another leg down, and we get the historical returns that dislocations have provided, we'll be happy. And if it continues to dislocate, we'll have anticipated that, and we'll continue to bring that into the portfolio as well. I think the risk that we all have to manage for is kind of waiting for the bottom, waiting that when we're all certain and we're comfortable, because I suspect with high-quality fixed-income securities, as Mohammed said, there's a lot of bias towards investment-grade securities outside of emerging markets that will probably start to pull up emerging markets. By the time we all figure it out, it may be too late, which is why we're willing to take this down in thirds and take a little bit of risk on the front end. Philip, if you have anything to add on the flows?
Yeah, it's Philip here. I can maybe differentiate a little bit. We have seen deleveraging more in Asia, where a lot of wealthy people are involved in the bond market directly, owning high-yield bonds, Chinese property bonds, stuff like that. And they had margin calls. So on the days where those margin calls were coming in, these bonds dropped 10, 20 points on one day. And then we have the overall kind of ETF selling, which is mainly concentrated on sovereigns. So there are different forces at play.
Operator, any more questions in the queue?
Yes, we have received another question electronically, so I'll go forward with that one first. The question is directed to Mohammed. Mohammed, why hasn't President Trump called out Saudi Arabia and leaned on them to restore oil prices in regards to Saudi Arabia and Russia coordinating these recent oil supply changes and major price dislocations? And further, why haven't U.S. oil executives called out Trump and Senate to pursue Saudi Arabia to support oil price recovery, which has damaged the U.S. oil industry?
That's a great question. I suspect that both President Trump and oil executives have reached out to Saudi Arabia privately. I don't know whether I know they haven't done it publicly, but I highly suspect they've done it privately. So let me explain why I think so. First is that Saudi Arabia would have, in order for it to pivot back from what it did, I'll come back to it as to why it did it, but it basically said, I will no longer be the swing producer in the oil market. I will no longer reduce my output in order to support prices. In order for it to pivot back, That it also has to do with while saving face. And you don't want to do that when you're under pressure from the U.S. So I suspect the pressure was there, but private rather than public. But let me say, it's really hard for Saudi Arabia to do that without Russia also coming and cooperating. And imagine you're Saudi Arabia, and imagine you're facing a big decline in demand at the same time as the other producers are not willing to reduce the output. You're basically left with the following choices. Choice one, continue the role of swing producer, cut your output. It's probably not going to be enough. So you're going to end up both with lower prices and lower output. That's option one. And that is continue with the role of swing producer, even though Russia doesn't want to play that role. Two is do the opposite. Try at least to capture a bigger market share because you're the lowest cost producer out there, and flood the market in the hope that in the short term you at least gain market share, and over the long term you force Russia and other producers to come back in. I think Saudi Arabia, that's what Saudi Arabia did in 2014-15. It worked well in terms of disciplining other OPEC members, and it brought Russia into the OPEC Plus. I think this time around it's going to take longer because Russia also needs to find a way to save face. That's one. And two is that demand continues to slip. Base bottom line is I suspect that they reached out to them privately rather than publicly. Having said that, it's going to take time for the OPEC Plus construct to come back together. I think it will, but it's not going to be as quick as it was in 2014, 2015. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mohammed. Operator, I see we have another question live in the queue. Could you please open that question up?
Sure. Our next question comes from Albert. Please proceed with your question.
Thanks, everybody. Hi, this question is for Mohammed. Question is regarding to inflation in the United States and the yield curve. Knowing what you know about the stimulus package and perhaps what you expect, thinking about your base case, how do you see United States inflation evolving here through the next 12 months, and as well as how do you see the yield curve being impacted?
That's also a great question and really, really hard to answer. I don't know is the bottom line, but let me tell you what I would look at. First is I would look at the race between in the next few weeks and months between supply destruction and demand destruction. It's happening simultaneously. If you're an economist, the curves are shifting, and what happens to price levels will be dependent on the extent of the curves shifting. I think this is going to be much more of a product and segment-specific story than will be anything else. So, if you still are interested in staying at a hotel, price will be completely really low. Prices are coming down incredibly. Simple reason why demand has completely collapsed and you can't take supply that quickly off. But if you are looking for hand sanitizer, that's a completely different issue. So I think in the short term, it's going to be about particular sectors, and it's going to be about the amount of supply and demand destruction. I think once we recover, we are going to have so much stimulus in this economy that for the sectors that are still viable, those who haven't had liquidity become solvency problems, for the sectors that are still viable, they're going to have the tailwind of both increasing demand and increasing prices. Because as I said earlier, you do not restart an economy as interconnected as the global economy is, like flipping a switch. That simply doesn't happen. So I think that we are going to see higher inflation, but the timing of that is a health issue. I keep on coming back to that. This is about your confidence about being able to contain, treat, and increase immunity. That's ultimately what will determine the inflation. Your very, very insightful inflation question, going from being sector and company specific to being macro. Thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed. That concludes the question and answer session for today. If you have any additional questions, please feel free to email them over to investorrelations@gramercy.com, and we will be sure to get back to you. At this time, I will turn the call back over to Robert for closing remarks. Robert?
Great. Thanks, Lacey. Thank you again, everyone, for joining us today. We'll endeavor to continue to provide these update calls on a regular basis. We apologize again for the wait that people had getting into to the call. In the interim, our mission is to positively impact the well-being of our clients, our portfolio investments, and our team members. And as such, if there's anything that we can do to help you navigate these challenging times, please let us know. Thank you again for your participation, and we'll look forward to speaking again soon.
And this concludes today's conference, and you may disconnect your lines at this time. Thank you for your participation.